CSLA with Rocky Lodka.
The Azure DevOps Podcast is a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Each show brings you hard-hitting interviews with industry experts, innovating better methods, and sharing success stories. Listen on to learn how to increase quality, ship quickly, and operate well. And now your host, Jeffrey Palermo.
Welcome to the show. I'm Jeffrey Palermo, your host for helping you and your teams move fast, deliver quality, and to run your software with confidence in Azure, all while using everything that the .NET ecosystem has to offer. The podcast is sponsored by ClearMeasure, a software architecture company that empowers .NET teams to be self-sufficient and able to deliver world-class results. They are hiring architects as well as .NET engineers who'd like a path to become an architect. You can go to clearmeasure.com/careers for that. And if you have a comment or question for the show, just send me an email at podcast@palermo.network. And also, my new online TV show has launched. So you can go and search for Programming with Palermo, quote, in any of the podcast directories or YouTube online. You can also find every episode of the new TV show at www.palermo.network. Excited to get that rolling. You can also send me feedback just by emailing programming@palermo.network for that one. And now let's get on to our guest. A repeat guest back from episode 33, Rotford Lodka is the creator of the widely used CSLA .NET open source development framework. He's the author of numerous books and regularly speaks at major conferences around the world. Rocky is a Microsoft regional developer and MVP, and he's the co-chair of the Visual Studio Live conference and the chair of the Cloud and Containers Live conference. Rocky has worked on many projects in various roles, including software architecture, design and development, network administration, project management. And over his career, he's designed and helped to create systems for biomedical manufacturing, agriculture, point of sale, credit card fraud tracking, general retail, construction, healthcare, the list goes on. But he likes to think and talk about software development and architecture, cloud computing, microservices, and he blogs at blog.lotka.net. That's LHOTKA.net. And excited to welcome him back to the show. Rocky, how are you, sir?
I am great. I'm really, really happy to be here.
Awesome. Glad to have you back. We'll include a link to episode 33 when you were on before. Actually talking just about the general topic of software architecture and your thoughts on it, because you've had a long career focused on business software. So you've probably seen, gosh, just the number of projects, it would take you a long time to just even list them out.
It would. I have had the opportunity to do a lot of different things. And of course, you'll learn a lot of lessons each time you do something and make a mistake, then you learn something good.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I always like to ask the guests, and this is kind of a long time ago now, but do you remember what steered you into a career in custom software?
Yeah, I do, actually. So I'm not young. And so when I was a kid was when arcade games were just actually starting to become a thing. Mm-hmm. And I, like pretty probably everybody at that point, was fascinated by arcade games. And like the movie Tron came out. And mm-hmm. But I distinctly remember an Asteroids game that was networked to another Asteroids game. It was in an arcade. And I thought, how is this possible that my friend and I were standing at two different devices, you know, two different game consoles playing, and yet we could see each other? And I'm like, wow, this is so cool. And that's really what did it. I'm like, I want to be able to do this.
Nice. Now, just out of curiosity, do you like to use like the retro gaming console, like the RetroPie and the various emulators for some of those old arcade games?
No, I have not gotten into that. For a while with the original Xbox or one of the Xboxes, you had access to a lot of games like Joust and mm-hmm. Asteroids. And maybe that's still true. I have kind of fallen away from the console gaming, but no, I've never gotten into that whole hardware building thing.
I just stumbled back upon it. And yeah, apparently there's people that are selling stand-up cabinets with 30 consoles and 30,000 game titles built right in to a cabinet. You know, they're not selling them cheap by any means, but.
Oh, I'm sure not. That's right.
Well, kind of want to get into it. You've been working for a long time on a very similar topic. I want you to introduce your product, and I'd like to go through the concepts of it. You've been working and consulting and supporting CSLA. There's probably a good number of listeners out there that, you know, aren't familiar with it or never used it before. So can you give us an overview of what is it and what problems does it solve?
CSLA has the tagline, a home for business logic. And really, throughout my career, I've observed that companies, including Microsoft, but many others, are pretty darn good at building UI frameworks, you know, like Windows Forms and Blazor and all of this stuff. And I think you could lump in, even though it's not Microsoft, but you could say, you know, Angular. The industry at large is really good at creating UI frameworks. How's that?
Yeah.
And the industry at large is pretty good at creating data access tooling, you know, Entity Framework or Hibernate or JDBC. You know, there's just everybody has many options on how you should talk to a database, probably too many options. Mm-hmm. And what I've observed, again, like you said, my career has been building business software, usually complex business software. And so it's great that I can talk to the database, and it's great that I can build a fantastic user experience. But every business application has complex business rules and business logic. And so then the question is, where does that go? How do you organize that? How do you make it consistent? How do you make it maintainable? How do you make it so that it can stand the test of time? Because most business apps also have a lifespan of maybe like 15 years. Mm-hmm. And that's what CSLA is focused on. First and foremost is giving you a consistent way of building all that business logic.
Okay. Well, and tell us what it stands for.
Ah, it's one of those things that, so when CSLA was first created, it was in the 90s, and acronyms were a big deal back then. Everybody wanted to have an acronym. And in fact, if your acronym had an X, it was even better. I missed the boat on that. So it used to stand for Component-Based Scalable Logical Architecture.
There you go.
But like so many things, you know, acronyms fell out of favor, and it's actually not accurate anymore either. That acronym. So now CSLA is just a word, an unpronounceable word.
Yeah. We won't attempt to make a pronunciation for it. So you mentioned business logic, and you're right. All these frameworks are good at getting either one computer to talk to another computer, or a human to talk to the computer, or the computer to store in a database or come back, or heck, integrate over and send a text message to mobile phones. You're integrating with other stuff. But then the guts of the application, there's no file new project for the center of an application or what the application actually does. So you mentioned business logic. Is there a good definition? How do you define what business logic is and what other stuff is not business logic?
That is a tough one. I agree. And it's kind of contentious depending on your background and viewpoint. But the way I think about it is that if I'm given a set of requirements by my end users, that which we all are, right? I mean, mm-hmm. At the end of the day, we're creating software for some end users, and they have a scenario. I often call it a user scenario that they're trying to accomplish. You can sit down and have a conversation, and they're like, "Hey, I need to do this, this, and this." And I would like the computer to help me, mm-hmm. right? I mean, really, that's... And so then you start thinking, okay, well, for that to happen, clearly we as developers start to think, well, what data is necessary to make that happen? And as you and I talked about, there's a lot of data access frameworks. And a designer might come in and start sketching out possible user workflows and screens And that's all great. But if you listen to what the user is talking about, there are a set of rules, like people in a given role can do this, and people in a different role can't do that. And people in a given role can see this data, and other people can't see this data. And this has to be calculated. Here's how these values combine to calculate a new value. And this field is required, and that field is not required. That one has to be a number. That one has to be a future date. That one has to be a past date. There's all these things are business rules. And so in I always kind of bring it back to say, well, anything that constrains the behavior or calculations or anything data manipulation, those are all examples of business rules. Mm-hmm. And this is where it can get contentious, because then by that definition, business rules include things like validating input. Mm-hmm. And people sometimes are like, well, I validate all that in the UI. And that's true, but that doesn't mean that it's not business logic. Or authorization, you know, who's allowed to go to a given screen, or who's allowed to see a particular value, or who's allowed to edit a particular value. Those are business rules. And people often say, well, that's authorization, that's security. But it's really not. Authentication is security. Mm-hmm. Right? I'll prove you are who you say you are.
Yeah.
But once I know who you are, those are all business rules as to who can do what.
So are there well-defined categories? You listed out some things. You're in a screen. Some people shouldn't be able to see certain data points and, you know, validation. But then you have calculations. Are there, in our industry as a whole, I know you've been at the forefront of business rules and defining it. I haven't seen, a definitive list, but would you suggest certain categories that we could hang our hat on? Or is it not?
I would.
Okay.
Within bounds. Yeah, certainly, like I said, authorization, validation, data manipulation. So having changing one value causes the calculation of other values. And then algorithmic processing is the third category that I tend to, which is like, if you're working in insurance, for example, a lot of industries, actually, mm-hmm. there are some cases where you do some pretty big algorithmic calculations to figure out things. And it goes way beyond the user changed a field and we're just recalculating the subtotal on an invoice, you know? So those are the broad categories I usually cover. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's an exhaustive list. And the other, I guess, higher level way I think about it is, over time, we know, especially you and I, folks that have been doing this for a while, for certain that we will end up rewriting our data access layer because some new and theoretically better way to talk to the database will come along. That doesn't change business logic. Mm-hmm. That's busy work that we're doing so that our code doesn't become obsolete. And the same is true at the presentation layer. We know that over the lifetime of an enterprise app, if it were economically feasible, the users would love it if we would tear off the UI and rebuild it probably around year 8. Mm. Because that's the point at which everything has changed. And our application now looks ancient and crusty, and it still does everything, but the users are like, man, this thing is old. And so this is, and I'm getting to a point here, which is, were you to take away the database and were you to rewrite the complete UI, everything else is business logic. Mm-hmm. Right. And what happens though in reality is, because there's not a home for business logic, the business logic almost always ends up being written in the UI.
Yeah.
And behind button click events or in controllers or in view models, all sorts of places where it does not belong. And then when you get to that year eight, where you want to replace the user experience, it's totally impossible economically because you have to rewrite all your business logic because you put all your business logic in the UI.
And now it's gone.
And this is why we have people still maintaining Windows Forms apps, you know, because they, yeah, it'd be great to move forward into something more modern, but all the business logic is written in lost focus events and button click events.
And all those big green screen apps that are still hanging around.
Oh yeah. Right. Exactly.
Just, it's a huge, huge lift.
That's the definition of monolith there, right?
So if you take away your database and you take away your UI, which I think I like to think about it as an interface to the human, an interface to the user, if you take away the code that interfaces with other stuff, do you have anything left? So then really what we're defining here is your application, what the application actually does as opposed to what the application talks to. Is that phrasing it right?
You said that very well. Thank you. Yep, that's great.
So I've seen a lot of code, and of course, you know, before I grokked this concept earlier in my career, I would write business logic as just if statements, case switch statements, and just adding more private methods and whatnot. But is it always the case, or not quite, that you want to put business logic in objects, you know, with object-oriented programming versus just adding an if statement somewhere in an entity? How do you think about it? Are there rules that you depend on there?
In my case, I chose to use an object-oriented approach and ultimately took an idea from a guy named David West, who is a computer science professor and wrote a book quite a while ago now called Object Thinking. And in that book, and I took a class from him as well, he talked about self-evaluating rules as a concept. And more or less what he was talking about was every rule is implemented as a class. And that way and that's what CSLA does. Mm-hmm. And so the idea being that you can unit test your rules because the rule is a thing unto itself. It's a first class citizen.
Yeah.
And then you can attach those rules to properties or other events that happen in your app as you need them. And so, for example, you might have a rule that verifies the shape of a phone number, and then you would attach that to every field or property that has a phone number throughout your app. And then the idea is that suppose you start in the US and then you say, oh, but now we're doing business in the UK or in some other country where the phone numbers have a different shape. And how many places in your code base do you have to go modify code to make that possible?
Mm-hmm.
And in most applications I've ever worked on, you have to go everywhere, right? Yeah. But if you follow this approach, you just enhance that one rule to accommodate the new capability of we've added a country and with a different possible format, and all of a sudden everything works everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not the only way to implement business rules. I'm sure, there are a lot of ways to do it, but there are three big ways that I've seen over the years. The first I encountered is what today we'd call a function library. So basically each rule is a function or a procedure. This dates back to COBOL and Fortran, when those were our only tools. And every rule was a method that you would call. And that worked okay, but it was not particularly great. But you can still do that today. And people do in .NET. And they write all of their rules. Every rule is a function or a method. And you just call it at an appropriate point. Another really, what's become pretty common over the years is a rules engine. And so things like BizTalk Server used to have a rules engine. And I think that's now probably part of Logic Apps in Azure. There are companies like InRule that sell commercial rules engines. And these things, basically, you take a data object, like a POCO, an entity, a DTO, whatever you want to call it, and you send that into the rules engine. And the rules engine is kind of like a pipeline. It just does an assembly, right? It checks some things and it calculates some things. And then at the end, you get back the same entity object, but it's been changed by the rules. And so that works really good in server-side computing, but doesn't work well to create an interactive user experience.
Yeah.
And so, and then the third being objects, which I've already described. And so of the three, especially creating interactive user experiences, I personally continue to think that using object-oriented concepts is the way to go.
Many thanks to our podcast sponsor, Clear Measure. Clear Measure is a software architecture company that empowers clients' development teams to be self-sufficient, moving fast, delivering quality, and running their systems with confidence. Whether starting a new project or developing new technologies or techniques, Clear Measure sets up your team to deliver world-class results. Learn more at www.clearmeasure.com. Clear Measure, empowering software delivery. Clear Measure is also happy to be a sponsor of the video podcast, Programming with Palermo. Watch, learn, and program alongside Chief Architect Jeffrey Palermo. Videos are added weekly and available on syndicated locations supporting video podcast or by visiting palermo.network. Tune in today.
As you're talking about objects versus functions, it clicked for me that if we start with an if statement, for we recognize, oh, in this scenario, we have to do one thing, and that's an if statement, and you just put it in regular code, somebody else has to go and read that later and figure out what's important here. What are we actually trying to do? I can see what the code is doing. It's just comparing one variable to another. But when you elevate it to an object, you're forced to give it a name. And is that... That seems to be if with the customer, with the business users, whoever in the organization, if they're forced to, sometimes they describe it with words that are clear, but sometimes they have to give it an actual name. And then, like you said, you can test it. Well, what are you testing? Well, you're testing a nameless thing or something that has a name. Is that a big idea or is that just a detail?
No, I do think it's a big thing. I think it comes into the idea of elevating business rules to be a first-class concept. And in C#, VB, the way that we elevate something to be a first-class concept is to make it a class.
Yeah.
I suspect if you're using functional programming like F# or ML, then the way that you get something to be a first class construct is you make it a function.
Right.
But I haven't used those tools, and I suspect most people haven't either. So
yeah. What's your preferred naming convention for business rules? There's other naming conventions for the data access layer and UI and API controllers. Is there a good naming convention that people can latch onto for rules?
My convention is to use a verb in the name. So something like phone number validator or discount calculator, mm-hmm. or something along that line. Some people look at that, and especially when you're saying, required field validator, that gets really long. And so then they might say, no, we're just going to drop the word validator. And that's okay, as long as you don't start running into naming conflicts. Mm-hmm. And for the most part, I think that's okay, because I also personally make heavy use of namespaces to keep things like rules organized. And so I think it can go either way, depending on how much you enjoy typing and how much you enjoy relying on IntelliSense, right?
Right. Okay. So if you have a bunch of validators and you have a namespace that is validators, then the classes inside just don't all have to have the word validator in them.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes. And I don't think there's a right or wrong answer. I think it's just important to pick something like one of those two options so that you have some organization and your code remains readable.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. Are there fully fledged sample applications that listeners can have access to that show properly implemented business rules?
There are. So CSLA is, you referred to it as a product, and I think that's accurate, but it's an open source product. Okay. So the whole thing is on GitHub, including the CSLA source code. And I'm not the only maintainer, although I am the primary maintainer, but I think the CSLA 6 that just came out, I want to say we had over 40 people that contributed to it. Mm. But to your point about samples, in the GitHub repo, there is in fact a samples folder. And in there are a lot of different sample apps that demonstrate different features of CSLA and how to do certain things, including a couple that are completely focused on the rules engine.
Okay. Do you remember off the top of your head which ones would be focused on rules, since we were just talking about that? So we can kind of steer them in, because yeah, I just pulled it up. There's quite a few.
In the samples folder, there are quite a number of projects, but the business rules demo is probably the one that walks through all the different ways to build business rules using CSLA. And this is a good point for me to call out Johnny Beckham, who's a colleague and friend of mine from Norway, who contributed a lot to the rules engine. What you and I are talking about is really kind of the top level, right? This stuff gets, if you're building a complex insurance, banking, manufacturing app, the permutations and interactions between rules become very complex, and that walks through all of the options. The other project that's really good as a start point is Project Tracker, which is more or less it's as simple as it can be to show a lot of the concepts, and as complex as it needs to be to show all the concepts. And unfortunately, it's a little out of date right at the moment. That's my current project is updating that particular sample. That's usually considered like the reference app for CSLA.
Okay. Yeah, I'm looking at Project Tracker, and it has multiple UI samples. Oh, Blazor, WebAssembly, WPF, WinForm, Xamarin. So with CSLA focusing on the middle part of the application, is it a fair assertion to say that regardless of database technology and regardless of UI technology, it will fit, it's compatible?
Right. And that's a second kind of area of focus for CSLA is, and again, because my career has been spent building these enterprise business apps, is this recognition that ideally your business logic will survive tearing off and replacing the UI. So CSLA, as much as possible, tries to give you this home for business logic, and then also provides some buffer or abstraction between your business logic and everything from Windows Forms all the way up through Blazor. Mm-hmm. And the same is true with data access layers. If you follow the architecture that CSLA recommends, then your data access code ends up isolated in its own layer. So that when you have to switch from, you know, Entity Framework 5 to Entity Framework 6 and rewrite all your business logic, or data access layer code, you don't have to rewrite your business logic. In fact, ideally, you don't have to touch your business logic. You just replace the data, you know, access code. So yeah. Again, the idea being to keep your business logic intact and functional for the long haul. And by long haul, you know, we're talking 10, 15, 20 years.
Yeah, for sure. If we're in the middle of the application, does, and folks want to make use of CSLA, does it color how the whole center of the application is built? Or can you just take one section and use parts of CSLA in individual sections, but not the whole? How does it like to be used?
It likes to be everywhere. Okay. Throughout the middle. But I do think you certainly, if you know, recognizing that existing apps have their own architectural choices that are in place, you definitely can take user scenarios and use CSLA to implement them or to re-implement them. And I think that's kind of the lowest block if you conceptually that CSLA can function at is a user scenario. And so what I mean by that is I need to bring up and edit some configuration data for the, let's say, a manufacturing machine, right? I've got something on the shop floor. I need to be able to, I the user, need to be able to bring up, open the configuration, look at it, edit it, and save it. That would be a user scenario. And you probably already have that in your app, along with, you know, hundreds or thousands of other functions, but you could take that one function and rewrite it to use CSLA. And then slowly over time, you know, be rewriting other function or user scenarios to use CSLA.
Okay. So for a user scenario, it likes to be everywhere from beginning to end, but it really doesn't care if it's used in one user scenario versus all of them. So you can take an existing application and start to retrofit, but you just wanted one end-to-end slice at a time, I guess?
Yeah, right. The CSLA framework is geared around an architecture that where you have at the center this business logic layer, and below that you have a data access layer, and above that you have an interface control layer, which is usually... And that interface control layer is maybe a controller or a presenter or a view model. And then above the interface control layer is the interface itself, which might be HTML or XAML or JSON or XML or, you know, whatever your interface is.
Yeah.
And so CSLA is really focused primarily on that middle layer, the business logic layer, but it provides helper assemblies in, you know, NuGet packages for Windows Forms, for WPF, or you know, even Web Forms, MVC, Blazor, and you don't have to use those, but boy, your life is so much easier if you do, because that's where these the helpers that abstract how the business layer interacts with the presentation layer are abstracted using those, and so that's why when you look at the samples folder, you know, there's a whole bunch of isolated ones. There's Blazor example and Blazor server and MVC and Razor pages. And each one of those is very discreetly focused on how do I take how do I take the exact same business layer and bind it or otherwise attach it to all these different UI technologies? And then, you know, Project Tracker. And this is why Project Tracker takes longer to keep current, because it tries to do all of it in one project or one, you know, one solution. So it's complicated.
Yeah, what is that? I'm looking at 9 different UI projects for different technologies. Yeah,
exactly.
You've mentioned the benefit of, as we kind of wrap up here, the benefit of maintainability. And over the long term, you don't want to have to rewrite your application when the interface technologies change. But would you say that just because of how it's structured, it is faster for initial development as well? You mentioned some things that are just automatic that are really nice. A lot of times when we think about long-term maintainability, it's a trade-off, like a little bit more effort up front, but it's really going to pay off. Is that kind of the same situation here? Or is it even faster to get it working initially as well?
There's definitely a trade-off, and the trade-off with CSLA primarily, CSLA has been around a long time, and so I've had the opportunity to observe thousands and thousands of people using it. And yeah, there's a learning curve. I would argue that CSLA does make the initial development faster, only if you already know how to use CSLA.
Once you're trained.
Yeah. And that's really the learning curve for most people is not trivial, because most people have never thought about isolating business rules from their UI. We get trained on how to build our business logic in the UI. And so there's a lot of unlearning and a lot of relearning. And so, there's in practice, in reality, it's definitely a learning curve that slows you down to start with. And then once you and your team get up to speed, then I would say it's faster. And certainly the consistency that it provides gives you that long-term reduced cost. And I realize most of us are under a lot of time and budget pressure when we're building software. Mm-hmm. But a smart business owner, you know, whoever is writing the check that owns the software at the end of the day, they should be educated to understand that for business, you know, enterprise software, the real cost is not that couple million that it took to write the software. The real cost is what they're going to be paying for the next 10 or more years to keep this thing maintained and updated. And that's the real cost.
Right. Right. That's a good point. So when you mentioned people need to get ramped up and learn how to use it, I could say the same thing about anything new, right? But for people who have acquired the skill, for people who have done the training and now know how to do it, that's pretty compelling. Just, you know, hey, build your applications quicker as well. I mean, there's so many technologies out there that are aimed at build your applications quickly, but you still have to learn them.
That's true.
So I think, I don't see that as unique to CSLA because you have to, but anyway. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show and sharing, educating us about the latest in CSLA and business rules. It's fascinating, some of these things where maybe it's not economically viable for some of the vendors to push products around this, but they are timeless lessons where you're gonna get good at this either now or later with weeping and gnashing of teeth after you've made some mistakes.
This whole thing is born out of my experience, right? And exactly that you know, you write software, at least I wrote software, and then had to rewrite it and go, man, why am I doing this? There's got to be a better way. Yeah. And, you know, that's exactly right.
Well, my team is currently rewriting an application. A client came to us, and it was the same company that it hired me when I was 18, 19 years old to write an application, and they've been running it ever since. And so now, my team is writing some application that I wrote when I was 18, 19. And yes, everything is a method. Everything's sure, just a method, an if statement. And I mean, I didn't know objects of any kind. Yep. So it's interesting. It's interesting. Well, thanks so much again, Rocky. And we'll put everything we talked about, links in the show notes, and listeners can grab those there and check out CSLA on the GitHub and go to blog.lotka.net to get in touch with Rocky. And thanks so much for coming back on the Azure DevOps podcast.
This has been just wonderful. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. And until next time, keep shipping.
You've been listening to the Azure DevOps podcast, a show for developers and DevOps professionals shipping software using Microsoft technologies. Go to www.azuredevops.show for show notes and other episodes. On behalf of your host, Jeffrey Palermo, and our sponsors, thanks for listening, and may God bless you.